My castaway this week is Paul Weller. The lyricism, passion and integrity of his songwriting have guaranteed his place as a platinum-plated icon of music. To his devoted fans and the legions of professional musicians he's inspired, his position is unassailable. It all started, of course, with The Jam, not just in his words, three little geezers from Woking in black suits, but a band that set itself apart from the outset, chronicling the lives of Thatcher's children with bittersweet poetical insight. But that was all 30 years ago. He's moved on, and then some. Famously disbanding The Jam at the very height of its success, he was determined to pursue creative fulfilment, whatever the cost. And at times, that cost has been high. At one point, he was dropped by his record label and faced writer's block. For inspiration, he returned to his roots and embarked on the next stage of his musical journey. You've said in the past, Paul Weller, that you don't know why people bother to ask you all these questions, since all the answers are in the music. I mean, you're known for being quite a guarded character. Do you loathe being asked questions?
I don't know. Well, yes, I do loathe it sometimes, I suppose, but I don't know if it's just being guarded. There's some things I can't answer. When people say to me, where does that song come from whatever song it may be? And it's like, I don't know. It just arrived at my doorstep. I don't know. I mean, sometimes the songs are about something very specific, and other times they just come to you, you know. And I suppose I don't know the answer to a lot of those things because I don't care to know the answer, really. I quite like the magic that when you don't know the answer to it.
Does that mean then sometimes when you've finished composing a song and you look at the words, you find out things about yourself?
Yeah, you can. I suppose you can, yeah. But I think sometimes that process can happen weeks or months or years later, you know. And sometimes it doesn't happen at all, which is fine as well.
And how comfortable are you with, I mean, given, of course, that once you've written something down, the very private becomes public. Is that uncomfortable then, that people read you through your songs?
No, it isn't. It isn't at all. It isn't at all, because I mean, that's what you're trying to write. You're writing to communicate with people, so you couldn't take exception to that, you know. It's more, I don't sit and think where the songs come from. That's what it really is. Why do I write? I just do. I accept that's what I do in life. And that's what I've always done.
And given that it started when you were a teenager then, were you one of those teenagers who pored over the sleeve notes and read other people's words?
Yeah, totally, yeah. Every little single little word on the sleeve. And would know all the Beatle lyrics off by heart and the Kinks and all those bands, you know. And they would write my books. I was never particularly into books or into schooling or education. That was my education to me.
Tell me about your first choice today, then.
It was The Small Faces, and it's Tin Soldier, which is from 1967. I had to pick one band out from that era. I guess it's them, because I just thought they were... I just love everything about them. I thought they look like a proper band. They're all the same size. I love the way they look. So I love the sound. They look like a proper group. You know, there's just so few groups these days that look like that and sound like as well. And just how young they were. I mean, they were probably all in their sort of under 20s, but just the kind of sort of mature sound there that just encapsulate all of it for me.
I am a little tin soldier that wants to jump into your fire. Are a look in your eye, a dream passing by in the sky. So I don't understand, and all I need is treat me like a man. Cause I ain't no guy, take me like I am.
So now I've lost my way. I need help to show me things.
Small Faces and Tin Soldier, a huge influence on you, and probably one of the first groups you were saying that you loved. It was intriguing that you said there, you very openly said, you know, they all looked right, they were all the same size, but the look of it meant and means a lot to you.
Totally, yeah, because it wasn't just the music, it was the attitude, it was the haircuts, it was the clothes, it was everything, it was all encompassing. It all went hand in hand to me, the whole thing.
And so Little Paul in Stanley Road, what was life like for you then?
Well, it's just fun as I remember it. I mean, I don't know, you kind of always remember the best bits, don't you? I mean, we lived in a very modest working class sort of lifestyle and home, and but yeah, it was fun, I think. It was, you know, I remember it's been fun anyway.
And what sort of people were your parents? I mean, you're still very close to your parents, and I want to talk to you about your dad and your professional relationship with him later, but as a little boy, what sort of guy was your dad?
He was, they're both real characters, my mum and dad. They're very strong characters. So I think you have to be sort of strong to get a word in as well, you know. I mean, my dad just worked on the building. He was a scaffolder and did bricklaying, and my mum was a cleaner.
And they made a life for themselves very young. I mean, your mum was 18 when she had you, is that
she
right?
She was 18 when she had me, yeah. My dad was eight, in his early 20s, I think. So she would always be playing music. There'd always be the radio on, or she'd be playing records on the radiogram.
And what was your bedroom like?
Very small. I mean, we lived in Flanders. I mean, it sounds like a terrible cliche, but we lived in an old sort of Victorian council house. So we didn't have hot water, and there was still an outside toilet, and there wasn't any central heating. So apart from me saying that I enjoyed it, and there was sunshine, but it was also cold as well.
I suppose there's a lack of consciousness about that if you are surrounded by streets of people who live the same way as you do.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, it's only when I look back at it now, I think, isn't it odd that, you know, because even into like 1971, we didn't have any hot water, but I mean, you know, it's not that bad, I know. But at least there was a sense of community anyway, you know. The thing about, you know, sort of leaving your back door open was actually true then. You could do that because, I suppose, because there was nothing to nick anyway, because it wasn't yours, it was all on HP anyway. And everyone knew that in the area.
It's very interesting that you said it was a very sort of vocal, noisy house with these big characters. I mean, you were quite a shy boy.
Really shy, yeah, painfully shy. I still am, really. But, yeah, I mean, I was to the point, you know, I would only sort of talk if I was spoken to, and even then, really reluctantly. A bit like these interviewers. But, I can always remember saying to my mum, I'm going to go and play a gig next week. I'm going to play with a mate of mine who's played in this club around the corner from us. And she couldn't believe that I would actually stand up on stage and do that.
Did the nerves and the shyness go away when you were on stage, or did you just have to sort of deal with them because you loved the music?
I dealt with them, I suppose, up to a point, but it's kind of, even to this day, not as extreme as that, but I mean, I still get really, really nervous before I go on, always, every single gig I've ever done, even from last week to 20 years ago. And that never gets any better. And before a gig, at least an hour or so before a gig, I just wish I was anywhere else but in this building. And then as soon as I get on stage, after sort of a song or maybe two songs, it's just like the best place in the world. I never ever want to leave it. And it's just such a weird thing, really.
What are you nervous about? Can you pin it on anything?
I have no idea, because I know there's not, you know, I'm not going to forget the words, forget the chords. I mean, none of those things matter anyway, but I have no idea. I suppose it's just that thing of standing up in public and just sort of, you know, bearing your soul a bit, really, or exposing yourself in that way.
Tell me about your next piece of music, then.
The next one's September in the Rain by Dinah Washington. I suppose it makes you think of your mum and dad and that time, that period of time, I suppose. You know, being a sort of really small kid and hearing that sort of music. It was still in that age of romance, really, and innocence, I think, and just beautiful arrangements. The strings were great and the melodies and all that stuff. But there was a sense of, sense of innocence in the music.
The leaves of brown came tumbling down, remember, in September. In the rain, the sun went out just like a dying ember. That September, in the rain, to every word of love I heard you whisper. The raindrops seem to play a sweet refrain. Though spring is here, to me it's still September. Ooh, that's September in the rain. To every word of love I heard you whisper. The raindrops seem to play a sweet refrain. No, spring is here. To me, it's still September. That's September. In the rain, I felt that September. In the rain.
Dinah Washington and September in the Rain. I read that you were given your first guitar when you were, what, 12?
Yeah, I was about 12, yeah.
What did you do with it? Did you love it from the first moment you met it?
I did love it, yeah, but more in a sort of posing way, really.
What, you mean posing, like in front of the mirror?
Yeah, totally, yeah. I can remember from the age of 10 onwards, I was sort of had feelings I wanted to be in a band or make music. So they bought me a guitar for me 12th birthday, and then I had some lessons for a little bit. I just learnt some really basic stuff on the guitar, and then yeah, just played along to records, and that's how I learnt, really.
I read that you hated school, which I suppose is normal fear for people who end up being rock stars. What was it you hated about it?
I don't like being told what to do, I suppose. You know, I mean, that's the bottom line, really. I didn't like having to wake up every morning and go to the same place and come home and all that stuff, the whole regularity of it. And I suppose music sort of represented a way of escaping that a little bit.
And so did you have this sort of other life, which was your real life, which was your musical life?
Yeah, what I imagined to be, you know, my real life. But I think it was a way of escaping that. It was a way of escaping that, you know, just doing the mundane and just going out, I'll leave a school and doing a mundane job. I just sort of way of escaping all that and getting away and seeing the world and meeting different people, all those things, you know.
What did your parents expect of you? Because, of course, a lot of parents get, rather...
They didn't expect anything at all because, you know, the sort of background I come from, which is totally unacademic, and, I mean, their jobs weren't going anyway, so they were quite happy for me to try and get into music and do that.
Right, so they saw that as... I mean, I'm interested in the fact that they saw that as a realistic possibility. You know, a lot of parents would say, you know, to get that idea out of your head.
No, this is a realistic possibility. I mean, my dad more so. We obviously saw something in me that possibly other people wouldn't have seen, I don't know. I always liken it to, he was a boxer as well, and I always liken it to like boxing trainers, where they might see two kids fighting, but they'll see one of them's got something that the other one hasn't, and they just need to draw it out from a bit more. And I always think maybe it's a bit of that in his eye as well.
Tell me about your next piece of music now.
It's Charles Mingus, and it's called Better Get It In Your Soul. Well, I'm a big jazz fan, but I especially like Charles Mingus' stuff. I just think it's really funky as well. It's really soulful, funky, and he's also a great composer as well. It's not just about soloists.
Mingus and Better Get Hit In Your Soul. It was 1973 then, I think you were 15 when you got your first gig. That was at the Walton Road Working Men's Club. Was that in Woking?
It was in Woking, Working Men's Club. Yeah, I was 14 actually, the first time I played.
Can you remember?
I can remember, yeah, very distinctly, yeah, because it was me and another fellow called Steve Brooks, who it was kind of me and him who sort of started the jam off, really. But, I mean, the Working Men's Club was literally around the corner from where we lived, and my dad just sort of hustled a little half-hour slot or whatever on a Wednesday night, where we were just playing to probably five old geezers all just drinking. And
what did you play?
We just did covers. We did like rock and roll covers, Chuck Berry songs, anything that had three chords in, really.
And did they applaud those four or five geezers with their pints? Did they?
I don't know if they did at all. They probably just made like, get them off, get those kids off. But it didn't matter. It was kind of, it was the first time for us, and it was kind of like, well, you know, we could do this actually. And then I think also after we did a gig at school in the lunchtime in the music room, the whole audience, if you can call it that, was just all girls, and we just thought, well, this is definitely a good job. It's a kind of defining moment for us, really. We felt kind of different. We thought we were separated from the rest of the pack in there. In a kind of youthful, arrogant sort of way.
And your dad's role in all this, do you think he just wanted something for his boy to do in the evenings on weekends, or do you think he saw there was a plan?
I think he could see we could take much further. We must have spent a good sort of 5 years playing workingmen's clubs and social clubs around Surrey. Whenever you get disillusioned, he was always one of sort of say, listen, you know, we've got to keep at it because, you know, we can get a deal. This thing could happen.
And as you said, he worked on building sites as a labourer and even a taxi driver and various different jobs. How did he begin to be a manager? I mean, how did he learn to be a manager?
He had a lot of fun, and he would never get embarrassed about asking people for whether it's money or equipment or borrow your van, mate, for a weekend, or going into a place and asking for a gig. And you need those sort of people when you're starting off. You need to have people who've got the balls to do that, you know. He came from him believing in us and believing in me and his son, and to him sort of hustling all this equipment and gigs, whatever it may be, right up until the time we actually got a deal in 77 with Polydor. And I remember at the time he was saying, well, I don't know if I should take this on any further because I'm kind of maybe out of my depth here. But I mean, all of us, and to give the other two in the band their due as well, we also looked at some rather, we're all going on together or not at all, so...
It would have been the obvious thing, of course, wouldn't it, to get a proper manager who had other groups.
Kind of being sort of thrown in the deep end with all these sort of music business types, but it was just kind of, we've all worked towards this for all these years, we're going to see it through, you know.
It's a classic thing for teenagers, I mean, especially people who haven't been particularly comfortable in school and aren't going to be academic, for them not just to rebel against school, but also, of course, rebel against their parents. You know, what could be more boring than your parents? It's intriguing that actually you became closer to your father as your teenage years developed.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was difficult sometimes because you're expected to rebel against your parents, and so you should as well. But he's as bad as me, or worse, actually. Anyway, I'm sure you won't mind me saying. You know, you kind of expected to do it, but there was nothing too much to rebel against, really.
And what about the moment of the record deal? I mean, that must have been a very big deal. It was £6,000 you were signed for, Polydor, 1977, did you say?
Yeah.
What can you remember of that?
We were glad to get it. We were skint anyway. We needed the money. We needed to get any sort. We'd have took any deal, to be honest with you, because we needed the money. It was at that point. It was kind of going to sort of continue.
Did you think we're on our way?
I suppose we did, yeah. I suppose we did think we were on our way, really. Yeah, I mean, I think even before getting the deal, we built up such a good following playing these pubs and clubs in town, in London. You could sort of feel there was something building up anyway. One of the first times I thought we'd really made it was we did a four-week residency at a place called the Red Cow in Hammersmith. And each week there was more and more people until, like, the last week there was, like, queues around the block. And you kind of thought, well, we've arrived.
Tell me about your next piece of music now.
It's James Brown's track, and it's called Don't Be a Dropout.
And why have you chosen it?
Well, I mean, I could have chosen sort of, you know, more the obvious sort of funky James Brown tracks, but this has got its own sort of funk.
Now, a good friend of mine sat with me and he cried, told me a story, I know he had a lie. Said he went for a job, and just a man said, without an education, you might as well be dead. Now, don't get me wrong, that it's not who you are, but people come to me from a near and a far. But I do just the work, and I follow the rules. I didn't have an education, so I had to go back to school. My friend told all his buddies that he loved so well, and all their personal troubles, I will not tell. Now, those guys didn't seem good, and they didn't seem bad. It didn't seem so happy, and I know they weren't sad. But the point isn't that they follow the rules. They got an education, and they all can choose. Now underneath his tears, I can see the truth back. When he dropped out of school, he never, never went back. Got to listen now. Hey, hey, without an education,
Brown and Don't Be a Dropout. So the Jam lineup proper then was you, Paul Weller, Bruce Foxton and Rick Butler. Did you have a sense that together you were making something special?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, it took us a few years to do that, but no, we, yeah, I think by sort of 76, 77, we've been playing for such a long time by that time. I mean, we definitely got a sound together anyway.
Were you very clearly the leader of the pack?
Yeah. I think if you're the songwriter in a band, I think you naturally are anyway. The band's whole direction is decided by the writer, really.
So it was 1977, and there you were, standing on the little stage on Top of the Pops with David the Kid Jensen saying, "Here's the Jam," within the city. I mean, what, that must have been sensational. How old were you?
I was 18 then. But it was sensational. Yeah, I mean, you know, because again, I mean, I've been watching, religiously watching Top of the Pops from, you know, mid-60s onwards. So to actually be on it was like, wow, you know, to actually make a record, to have this physical piece of vinyl in your hands, but there's your music on it, was just something else, you know. It's kind of everything we'd ever sort of thought about or dreamt about came true.
There was a sort of, I think it wouldn't be too strong a term to say, a sort of rage in it. I mean, there is a rage in the delivery, and there's a rage in the environment you find yourself in. Did you feel like an angry young man?
Yeah, totally, yeah. Britain at that time, I mean, it was the start of Thatcherism. There were strikes, there was power cuts, there was all that stuff going on, do you know what I mean? There was unemployment starting, there was all the race riots going on. So I think it was an angry time, I think. You know, I can't remember ever going to a gig around that time without ever seeing a fight going off, or, you know, there'd be a point in time where it would just kick off in the audience. People were naturally angry, they're just kind of, it's like, it's our turn now.
The lyrics of Down in the Tube Station at Midnight, I'm sure they've been quoted back to you many times. They're very powerful, about a man being beaten up down in the underground and... beaten up by a group of lads who, as you wrote it, smelled of pubs and wormwood scrubs and too many right-wing meetings. That would stand on its own without any music next to it. When you wrote that, did you feel like you'd hit the jackpot?
I thought we'd gone somewhere different with it, yeah. I thought we'd taken the music to a different level. But I think around that time, I started to get more into lyrics, into writing lyrics, and a lot of them started out as kind of more like sort of poems or prose or whatever you want to call it, which I would then sort of edit and adapt into a song and try and, you know, fit some sort of rhythmic thing into it. And I think the fact that was successful, it just kind of spurred me on to other things. Where I was kind of, you know, sometimes you need success to do that, you know.
Did you publish or edit a poetry magazine? I mean, you were quite serious about your poetry.
Yeah, I did, yeah. Well, I think I was just sort of catching up on a lot of things I didn't bother with at school, really, you know, just like reading a book or reading some poetry and just being opened up to different influences, really, and different ways of writing as well, you know.
Tell me about your next piece of music now.
Well, I thought I couldn't really be on your show without playing a bit of classical music, really.
So but you do like it, I hope.
I do like it. I love this, as I say, track. I don't know if you can allow that to call me.
Yeah, let's call it a track, I'm sure.
But anyway, but it's Debussy's Arabesque No. 1, and the version I've chosen is by Branford Marsalis, who put an album out called Romances for Saxophone probably 20 years ago. But all the choices on their record, anyway, kind of got me into classical music. Not in any massive way, but certainly an introduction to it as well, because he's first and foremost is a jazz player. But yeah, it really opened up that a different world to me anyway.
Branford Marsalis playing Debussy's Arabesque No. 1 with the English Chamber Orchestra. In the introduction, I mentioned, Paul, that you were in these sharp black suits from Burton's as the Jam. I mean, looking the part has always been, I mean, central to what you do, really. Why is it so important to you?
Well, I, again, just because I was obsessed with clothes, as obsessed with clothes as I was with music, you know. I mean, as a kid, you know, there was two boutiques, as they used to call them in those, in Woking, which I would just sort of go and just look in the window if I could spend like hours just looking in the window. It's just like Aladdin's cave to me. And I suppose I'm still like it now, you know.
Do you have a stylist or do you style yourself?
No, I just do it myself. I dress myself as well.
No, but I mean for the album covers. And you know, a lot of people who are in the music industry have somebody who says, you've got to wear the Dolce & Gabbana or you've got to wear the Alexander McQueen.
If you have to have someone tell you what you should be wearing, I mean, you might probably do when you're 5 or 6, but your mum does then. But I should be able to decide as a great option, yeah. But I think I just love clothes, you know.
Are you vain?
Yeah, I suppose I am actually, yeah. I try to be less so because, you know, it gets more and more difficult to be vain the older you get because you get more lines and grey hairs and your body starts going and all the rest of it. But I am, it's true. And my dad is as well, so obviously get it from him, I guess.
Are you one of those guys who spends a lot of time in the bathroom? You know, is there hair gel, is there eye cream, is there all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I do, yeah.
Good for you for saying that on mic. There's a lot of people
who wouldn't.
So, the Jam were shifting. I mean, a lot of singles, sort of 250,000 odd singles you might sell, potentially. I mean, just to give people an idea, now, if you get to number one, you've maybe sold 30,000 singles.
Yeah, I know.
It's different in those days.
I mean, you'd be number one for 10 years now if you sold that many records. I mean, it's incredible. But that was kind of pretty standard that time. Yeah, every single after a certain point anyway.
And you had a lot of big hits with the Jam, and it was December 1982 that you decided to break up the group.
Yeah, I just wanted to move on. As an individual, I wanted to move on. I mean, it could be seen as a selfish move because, you know, you've kind of got other people in, kind of rely on you as well. But I just knew it was just the right thing for me personally to do, you know. I just wanted to move on and just see what else I could do musically and in life generally, really.
What did your dad say when you told him?
I can't tell you exactly what he said because you won't be able to broadcast it on your show, but it was, you know, he just thought I was crazy.
And what was the future that you saw that you didn't want?
I didn't know, and I didn't want to sort of see one, to be honest. I just wanted to go somewhere different and try different things I wouldn't be able to do within the framework of the Jam. So that first year after the Jam split, 83, was just joy. It was just fun. It was just, you know, go away to Europe, you know, days or weeks or whatever, and just live anyway, just live a bit, you know.
And you set up the Style Council. Much to the distress of a lot of people at the time. Yes, a lot of those Jam fans really couldn't stick it.
No, that's right, yeah. It was kind of real, it was all division, I think. Some people stuck with it and some and liked it, and other people just didn't get it at all and hated it.
I mean, they sound like the sort of professional flowering and all these hits. It sounds like a kind of golden time. Was it a happy time for you?
It was a great time, yeah. It was a brilliant time then. I think for the first sort of three or four years of the Style Council, which was just fun. It was like being in a sort of gigantic moving youth club. It was just fun all the time.
Tell me about your next piece of music then.
This is by a young Irish singer-songwriter named Declan O'Rourke, and it came out probably about 2 years ago. And it's a beautiful track called Galileo.
Galileo fell in love as a Galilean boy. He wondered what in heaven, who invented such a joy, but the question got the better of his scientific mind, and to his blind and dying gaze, he looked up high and often sighed. And sometimes cry. Who puts the rainbow in the sky? Who lights the stars at night? Who dreamt of someone so divine? Like you and made them more.
Declan O'Rourke and Galileo. So we've spoken about this sort of golden period, if you like, And you also, of course, around about that time fell in love and had your first child. Did you feel like you were growing up? Did you feel it was a sense that you were moving on to a different part of your life?
Yeah, I mean, that came a little bit later. I mean, I think I was 30 when I had my first child, my son, Matt, with D.C. Lee. Yeah, I think having kids always makes you grow up, doesn't it? It has to, you know.
And then something extraordinary happened, which was you made an album that your record company didn't want to release. Was that, I mean, was that like a cold bucket of water down the back of your neck?
It was kind of sort of leading up to that anyway. It wasn't just about that record. I mean, they didn't like the record. They didn't want to release it. But it was also about money, as usual, anyway. But it was probably a wake-up call for me anyway, I think, really, which I needed, really, to get back to reality again.
And what about the point at which you couldn't really rely on your ability to write anymore? I mean, there was a moment when you just reached... You hit a wall, really, when it came to writing.
Yeah, I mean, it did hit a wall, and I think I didn't really sort of do any writing for probably, like, a year or 2 years or something like that. And it took me a long time to get back into it, really, and I think I only really sort of found myself again just through playing live to going out back out on tour. And it was almost like just sort of building up from scratch again, really.
And where was your dad in all of this at this point? I mean, you had such a close and fruitful professional relationship. When you were at sea, what was he saying to you?
He was saying something very practical, and that was like, so we've got to get back on the road and earn some money. So he always said it from a very practical standpoint, and I think you need people like that around again, you know.
Was he being more of the manager than the father then?
Yeah, totally, yeah. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Did you know when you got it back and you started writing the songs that were to go on to become your huge solo album hit, did you know you'd got it back? I mean, could you judge in that way?
To be quite honest, yeah, I did. By the time I did Wildwood, which was like the second solo album, I kind of knew there were some songs on that I thought were really special. It just felt natural again. It felt natural to write again, you know. And it felt very odd before that. It felt like almost like picking a guitar up was just really weird and alien to me. But it just took a while to get back into it, really.
Well, that's incredible that you say, you know, picking up a guitar was alien. I mean, this for somebody who just seems as though music is your life, and really without it you don't have much of a life. Was it a kind of depression? Was it a sort of, I don't want to get out of bed in the morning sort of stuff?
No, I wasn't get out of bed, because we've all got out of bed, you know. I mean, I have a small baby son as well, so you have to get out of bed. So that's, you know, I'm a very practical person as well. For me, it was getting back to just sort of playing electric guitar again with a drum kit and a bass player and getting out and just doing it from the roots. And that's really what it's about, you know.
It's a curious situation, isn't it, when you're somebody with all the talent? Because, of course, in a room full of people, we will laugh at your jokes a little louder. We will wait to hear what you've got to say. People who have got the talent to entertain and the charisma to entertain are indulged.
Yeah, definitely true, yeah. I think probably when my little star was in its ascendancy back in the early 90s, I really noticed it then. So all of a sudden everything I said was funny or interesting, which of course is impossible to be. I was being very indulgent around that time anyway, so it's probably kind of all went hand in hand in a way.
But it's interesting that, I mean, you had that huge wave of success with The Jam, and that didn't happen. It didn't appear anyway that you were somebody who was living the extreme rock and roll lifestyle. Why do you think it was that when it came around the second time you thought, right, in for a penny, in for a
pound? Well, I think it's probably all that thing of sort of getting to a certain age as well, you know. It's kind of, I don't know if it's a midlife crisis, but I mean, I was into my 30s by that time. I just enjoyed it all, to be honest with you. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, well, I didn't do it first time, so I'm going to do it now.
And what it was, the drink and the drugs and all the stuff that goes with it.
But I enjoyed every single moment of it as well, but it's just not where I want to be now, you know.
Tell me about your next piece of music, then.
This is by Nick Drake, and it's a beautiful song called River Man.
Betty came by on her way, said she had a word to say about things today. Foreign leaves, said she hadn't heard the news, hadn't had the time to choose a way to lose. But she believed, I'm
Nick Drake and River Man. So your father then was your manager for how many years?
It's only been the last sort of 3 or 4 years he's had to pack it in, had to retire, just for age and health, yeah.
Is that tricky then? Because, I mean, I imagine you've probably had a closer relationship than any artist and manager ever, given that he's your dad.
Yeah, it is tricky, yeah. You know, it means I'm doing it myself now, which isn't, that's not so difficult, I don't think, because it's all kind of up and running, really. But I just miss him as an entity, I'm beyond, especially on the road and just, you know, as a person. And we're sitting in a hotel bar together and having a laugh and just, you know. Because, I mean, apart from being my manager and my father, he's also my friend as well. So it's quite a unique situation, really.
Do you talk to him about aspects of your work still? I mean, would he? I know you're recording just now. Would you play him what you're recording? Would you talk to him about gigs?
Yeah, I do. And he's always very forthright, as he's always been as well, yeah.
Has he always liked what you've done?
Yeah, he always liked it. That's why I'm laughing. I played something the other day, which he definitely didn't like.
What did he say?
I can't repeat it on your show, unfortunately. Yeah, he's not one to mince his words, which I always like people anyway. But,
And does that matter to you? I mean, would you take that into account? No.
No, not so much. If I still like it, I like it anyway, as you know.
And what about music being a young man's game? I can't imagine that you look at the Rolling Stones and think, I'd like to be them one day.
It's a real tricky thing. I mean, I'm kind of in that weird in-between stage, you know, because I...
Well, you're going to be 50 next year, right?
I'm going to be 50 next year, yeah. On one hand, I don't sort of feel like I should pack in, because I'm working on a new record now, and I think it sounds every bit as good as I've ever done before. But then I sort of do look at the other generation beyond me and sort of think, I don't know, it doesn't look quite right, really. But then if you love it and you're still into it, I mean, what are you supposed to do? I don't know. I mean, what else would the Rolling Stones do but be Rolling Stones? I mean, you know, what would I do? What else would I do in life? I don't, you know, I just love music so much.
And you live now, you've got 5 children. You live now with your partner and 2 of your 2 youngest children. Is life mellower, generally? I mean, do you feel that there's been a sort of softening of the edges?
No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I've mellowed or not, I don't know. I mean, I don't find that my life is particularly mellow, because with 5 children, and especially young ones as well, it's pretty sort of manic, really. But great as well, you know, I wouldn't sort of change any of it.
What sort of father are you?
I'm pretty hands-on, I would say. I was pretty involved, I think. I mean, I love my children. They're my sort of saving grace, I think, really. I mean, it's time to sort of get really down or whatever. Or bored, just bored anyway, generally. But I think with kids, it's just always something interesting, something new to find, you know.
Tell me about your final piece of music, then.
This is by Roscoe Robinson. I mean, and it's a sort of late 60s soul R&B track. I mean, I could have chosen 1,000 of these sort of songs, but this one's good enough, I think, really. It's called That's Enough.
Robinson, and That's Enough. So I will give you the Bible to take onto this island and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you're allowed to take a book. What book will it be?
Probably Absolute Beginners by Colin McInnes, because it's a mod Bible. The book's amazing, I think, yeah.
Okay, you may have that.
Right.
And then to make life a little more bearable on this island, I will give you a luxury. What will your luxury be?
Settee. Something to sit on.
Not happy with the sand?
Well, it's just sometimes on a cold summer's evening, you might want to sit on something a bit more cosy.
It's yours.
Right.
And if the waves were to threaten to crash to the shore and wash away your eight discs and you had to run and save one of them, which one would it be?
Probably out of loyalty, probably the Small Faces. But on a musical level, probably Nick Drake.
Which is it?
Well, probably loyalty probably says the Small Faces.
Paul Weller, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
My pleasure, thank you.